This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. In my effort to keep the healthcare reevaluation debate going and encouraging people to learn as much as they can about it so that they can help affect change if that's what you think is needed, I want to make a comment again about something I've read recently. This is an editorial comment in the New York Times by Peter Singer. Peter is a professor of bioethics at Princeton, and he's also a laureate professor at the University of Melbourne. The title of his July 19th editorial was Why We Must Ration Healthcare. When we hear about rationing healthcare, I think there's a knee-jerk to think about keeping people from getting necessary medications, often extremely expensive and therefore limiting life. But it's much, much more complex than that. And in the United States, where many of us may think there is no rationing of health care, it goes on all the time. I would be first to admit that there's no country on the face of the earth that's been able to pay for all health care needs from birth to death, and it probably will never happen, at least not in my lifetime. I can't see that happen. But in the U.S., we ration it by cost and ability to pay, if you haven't thought about it. If you are on Medicaid or Medicare and can't pay for the cost of a medication deductible, you don't get that medication. You've been rationed. For many of us, we have health insurance because our health care employers have health insurance and because we can deduct the cost of health care insurance. So for many of us, we wouldn't have that if the government wasn't giving us what's estimated to be a $200 billion a year subsidy to pay for life for health insurance. Also, there's been studies in emergency rooms that demonstrate that if you are in the emergency room without a health insurance policy, you're more likely to die than if you did have life insurance. There's studies that show that there are excess deaths in individuals who have no health insurance. So rationing is occurring, whether you like it or not. It's, as Dr. Singer has said, he feels it's not only inescapable, but it's also desirable. July 19th, New York Times, Peter Singer, Why We Must Ration Healthcare. If you'd like to read more about the logic behind the need for rationing in all healthcare systems. Today we're going to be talking about Catholic social services and the homeless, and particularly the healthcare needs of the homeless. My guests in the studio today are Susan Bobolansky. Susan is the executive director of Catholic Social Services, and also Sister Jackie Stoll, who's a nurse practitioner working at the Brother Francis Caring Clinic. Welcome to both of you. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes, good to be here.
Let's start by talking about Catholic social services. That seems to be a good starting point. Susan, you want to tell us a little bit about Catholic Social Services?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Catholic Social Services has been around here in Anchorage for over 40 years. We were started and incorporated in 1966, and since then have grown to serve the multifaceted needs of the community. Last year, we served over 18,000 people here in Anchorage through a variety of programs. We actually have 9 programs. Two shelters for homeless individuals, the Brother Francis Shelter, which is for homeless men and women, Clare House, which is for homeless women with children. And then we also have two teen homes, which are for teenagers that are unable to live at their home at this time. In addition to our shelter-based programs, we have a food pantry, which is St. Francis House. We have special needs services, which provides respite care in the community and at home for individuals with developmental disabilities. We are the Refugee Resettlement Agency for Alaska, which is our Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services. We also have an adoption program, our Pregnancy Support and Adoption Services, and we have a Beyond Shelter Services program that works towards people that are with children, families with children living on the streets, getting them into appropriate housing. So quite an umbrella of activities.
So it's a nonprofit organization. When I looked up online, there's various cities have Catholic Social Services. This is a local statewide service pretty much, or is
it
just Anchorage?
It's just Anchorage. We're a part of the Catholic Charities USA network, which is a huge network across the country. Like you said, there's 170 different organizations like us. And there's one in Juneau, because that's a different diocese, and there's a small Catholic Charities in Fairbanks.
And the Brother Francis Shelter was one of your programs, and it is a shelter for homeless men and women, and that's what we're going to be talking about primarily today.
Yes, they're unaccompanied men and women without children. So.
And the Caring Clinic is part of the Brother Francis Shelter specifically, I take it.
Yes, yes, it is. It is actually located within the shelter itself. When the new shelter was built in
2005,
we were fortunate enough that a space was built in the shelter, a real clinic space, and that is where the Caring Clinic is located.
And you came to Alaska to be part of this Caring Clinic, to start it, or what got you here?
Well, I am a nun. I'm a Catholic nun, a Dominican sister from Adrian, Michigan. And almost 3 years ago, our congregation was asked to come to Anchorage by the Archbishop Roger Schweitz, to help minister in the Archdiocese of Anchorage. And my being a nurse practitioner, naturally I was interested in looking for ways to serve the community with my knowledge and my background. I have worked with the homeless population quite a bit, either in volunteer positions or also the populations that I cared for in previous jobs. So I have a passion, really, and a real interest in working with homeless folks. So when I came to Anchorage, I sought out the folks at Brother Francis Shelter and discovered in fact, there was somewhat of a clinic going on, not perhaps well organized, and was able to sort of step in and offer my services and help to bring about, I think, a more stable, ongoing, permanent presence within the shelter.
Prior to that, then, there was no specific healthcare individuals involved at the shelter?
There were, indeed. There were volunteers from the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. Some of their clinicians would come on a rotating basis about once every other week. And also residents from the family practice program at Providence would come every other week to hold one clinic session. There were about two clinic sessions a week. But with budget constraints at the Neighborhood Health Center, they were no longer able to come and provide services or supplies to the clinic. So the ability to care for people at the Caring Clinic was really decreasing and was constrained quite a bit by the time I got there.
Mm-hmm. How did funding work? I'm always interested. I think the listeners may want to know, where does the funding specifically come from? And then how did the additional funding come to support a regular program?
Right. Well, funding, there really was no funding per se for the clinic. It existed out of the generosity of the providers who came. Aside from having a space, that was pretty much all that was there. The Neighborhood Health Center did provide some basic supplies. And in the past, I know Providence had provided some pharmaceuticals, as did a Neighborhood Health Center, but it was very limited. There was really no funding per se. When I came in, I was able to meet with and talk to the very generous people at Providence who are now supplying us with basic pharmaceuticals that are really essential for us and basic supplies. We were also able to get a pretty good-sized grant through the Mental Health Trust Fund here in the state that has allowed us to now supply us with the things that we need to be there on a regular basis. So still there is no real funding. We rely on generous donations and what grant money we are able to get.
And I guess I would just add that applies to the whole shelter, the whole Brother Francis shelter. Out of the total budget, which is close to $900,000, half of it is covered by grants and contracts, and the other half is donated by our generous community. So we raise the remaining funds, and we also support it with United Way funds.
Having spent some part of my 30-plus years in private practice involved with public nonprofit organizations, when I hear the word grants, it rings up uncertainty in big letters. That is not an easy way to make a living.
It is not. No,
you never know what's going to happen. You're spending a tremendous amount of time and effort to get the grants, and then it doesn't take much. And
We could spend a lot of time on that one, but that is true.
It's true. However, I think because we are our staff is all volunteer, we are able, I think, to do quite a bit with the little that we have. And yes, our future is always a bit uncertain, but I think as long as we are determined to be there, we'll find a way to provide the services that are really desperately needed.
So the Caring Clinic is all volunteer, but Brother Francis Shelter does have paid staff.
Yes.
To understand the opportunities or the options or the lack of opportunities for the homeless, let me make sure I understand this question as well. Besides Catholic Social Services, are there other homeless shelters and specifically care options for the homeless in Anchorage?
Well, actually, Anchorage, there's not much duplication of services here. Some people may have heard of the Rescue Mission. The Rescue Mission is a smaller shelter that also serves men and women that has a proselytizing component to it. We don't have that at Brother Francis Shelter. So that is an option for individuals that are interested in that approach. Other than that, there's a Clare House that I mentioned for women and children. There's also McKinnell House for either a single parent father with children or a couple with children. And there's Awake, which is the domestic violence shelter.
Yes. And there are other care options in the city of Anchorage for people who are of Alaska Native heritage. There is, of course, the Native Medical Center. The Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center is the Alaska's federal health care for the homeless grant recipient. They are the ones who provide health care for the homeless through that federal monies that come into the state. They are limited to some extent. They do absolutely wonderful job of providing care. However, they have staffing constraints. They are at times difficult for people to get appointments. And though they are located close to Brother Francis, in the homeless population, you know, 4 or 5 blocks sometimes might as well be 10 or 20 miles away. People's lives are often so disorganized and chaotic that getting from one place to another can be almost an insurmountable barrier. So one of the things, and in fact research has shown, to increase the health of the homeless population and compliance is outreach and having services available where they are. And that's what really the kinds of service that we are offering at Brother Francis.
Flesh that out a little bit more. Why is it that proximity, providing outreach is so important?
I think there are several reasons for that. One is lack of transportation. Transportation here, of course, in the city, if you are relying on public transportation, can be a very, very challenging, even for people who have coping abilities and are not physically challenged. So add on to that any kind of mobility problems, any kind of you know, chaos in your life, trying to adhere to a bus schedule can be extremely difficult. Plus, the funds to get onto the bus is a whole other issue. So transportation is one problem. Another problem is that I think is that if you have substance abuse or mental health issues, keeping appointments is very difficult. And even if you don't, if you're homeless and your time is being consumed with finding a place to live, finding some food to eat, keeping your belongings together, making an appointment, even though it's 10 blocks away, is extremely difficult. So having services right in the same location increases compliance and helps people to get over that particular barrier.
I think for most of us, we just don't have a perspective. We don't think about transportation. We don't think about the difficulty of not having transportation and then having some other difficulty,
exactly.
Either mental health issues or physical mm-hmm. health issues. And then there's that final one. You don't have any money to afford what needs to be done.
Well, exactly. That's right. Being able to pay for your health care services. If you can't afford a house, if you have no place to live, no food to eat, health care becomes lower on your priority list for sure.
Mm-hmm. And that contributes, as we're going to talk about more, into the spiraling difficulty with
health. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, I think what I'd like to do now is go ahead and take a short break. I want everyone to know you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
The recorded rebroadcast of today's Line 1, Your Health Connection with Dr. Thad Woodard will repeat tonight at 8, and an archived copy will be available online at kska.org following today's live broadcast. KSKA is supported by listeners like you and Providence Alaska Medical Center. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of a stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. This is KSKA Anchorage.
This is Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today I'm talking with Sister Jackie Stoll, a nurse practitioner at the Brother Francis Shelter Caring Clinic, and Susan Bomolowski, who is the Executive Director of Catholic Social Services. We've been kind of fleshing out the understanding of the homeless, and we're going to do that a little bit more in just a second. Then we're going to get into the specific health care issues. But if you have questions or comments, there's a couple of ways you can get us over the next hour up until just before 3 o'clock. Our local number, 550-8433. You can call and address your questions there, 550-8433. Also, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as you are aware, if you've been listening to us recently, you can also email directly at line1. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, no spaces or anything, line1@kska.org. If we get your question in a reasonable time before 3 o'clock, we'll try to address it. And you may be listening also between 8 and 9 at KSKA, and this will be a taped rebroadcast, and there will be no questions at that time. Susan, let's try to clear up what I think are large misconceptions about the homeless population. Tell us what we know for sure about homeless people in Anchorage and Alaska.
Well, that's a great question. We just had a homeless count. It's called the Point in Time Count here in Anchorage in January. And that's done all across the country by different homeless coalitions. And here in Anchorage, we have an Anchorage Coalition on Homelessness. And what jumped out pretty clearly was the numbers. The numbers show that there's a huge increase in homeless families that are living with friends, doubling up, couch surfing, that type of solution to their homelessness, as compared to what most people think of when they think of homelessness is the person on the street with a sign that says, "We'll work for food." That number is actually much less than you'd think. The family number, out of the 2,962 individuals that were counted as being homeless in January, 73% were families with children. So it's a much higher number. And really, the average age that you hear is 9 years old, the average age of the homeless
person. This is another classic perception is not reality. I mean, we all who are not homeless are driving around and see the individual, male, sometimes female, asking for handouts, but that's the minority. And it needs to be clear that children and women and families are the bulk of the homeless.
Yes, and where that can become important is in some of the grants we talked about earlier. There's actually a Housing and Urban Development, the federal department has a definition for homelessness that involves how many times people have been homeless and how long they've been homeless and whether they have a disability. People that fall outside that are considered non-housing and urban development defined as homeless. Those are what we would say are staying in a motel because they can't afford a place to stay or with family and friends. And the funding isn't available to address some of the issues there. So that's, you know, while that is rising in association with the economic troubles in the country, the funding is not rising proportionately.
Another bit of myth and misconception that I found is that it is not true, and at least that's what I found, that most homeless don't work and get public assistance most of the time.
So, yes. Again, looking at the numbers being skewed towards the families with children, I mean, anybody that lives in Anchorage, which our audience does, understands the cost of housing here. And one illness, you're mentioning health insurance, we'll come back to that, but an unexpected illness, the costs associated with that. People are losing jobs. I mean, they're losing jobs here in Anchorage, maybe not at such a rate as in the lower 48, but you can't afford that payment anymore. And, you know, people have gotten caught in some of the foreclosures. We've also had a lot of people moving up from the lower 48 because they read the articles about how their job's here.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we've had people call from the airport to our Clare House homeless shelter and say, could you send a taxi to come pick me up so I can stay with you? Well, you know, people come unprepared. They come unprepared from other parts of Alaska also.
Yes.
I mean, we've heard about the rural migration, and that is true. We had a family from Dillingham show up, and they were on the streets. They had enough money for a hotel for a week and thought they could find a place and a job. And it just, when those things don't fall in place, it can easily end up in a spiral of homelessness.
But many of those individuals also would be working if they could and often have worked in the past month or so until they lost jobs.
Yes, exactly. In fact, people have left good jobs in the lower 48 to move here, you know, not realizing the cost here, the wages are not proportionally higher, you know, not being prepared even physically in the winter with proper clothing. And, you know, all the comments that are out there about the PFD and how you cross the border and you get a check for $3,000, people actually expect that, and they end up in our shelters.
And we do have, even at Brother Francis, we do have a number of individuals who are working and are still at the shelter because they are saving to find an apartment that they can afford to rent. So they will work jobs and yet come home at night to the shelter and do this for months at a time just to save up the money they need.
Jackie, let me get into the health care issue by also discussing one myth or misconception that I found by looking this information up. And incidentally, if our listeners go to our website, there's two links, one to Catholic Social Services and one to a government site on issues regarding health and the homeless. But I think the myth is that most people who are homeless are mentally ill or substance abusers, but the evidence is not that that's the case.
No, there is a percentage of the population certainly that are, and they are probably the ones that folks are most used to seeing or stand out more than others. Basically, there are about less than a quarter, 22, the statistic that I'm aware of is 22.4% of homeless individuals who had mental illness, a serious mental illness. So that's less than a quarter of the population. Now, the statistics on drug and alcohol abuse are a bit higher. I believe that some people will say up to I believe it's up to half, up to 50% or so with drug and alcohol abuse issues. The thing with that, though, is that You know, it's this kind of a two-way street. Certainly people who have drug and alcohol addiction problems do become homeless, but living in the conditions that homeless individuals are forced to live in oftentimes creates conditions that are easy for people to turn to drugs and alcohol in order to cope. So it's hard to sort of tease out who are homeless because they are addicted and who are using because of trying to cope with circumstances that they are in.
Yeah, and also it's important, again, to if you're looking at chronic homeless individuals, that's why I think the percentages, yeah. you mm-hmm. read different things. It depends how it's calculated. Yeah. Those numbers would be higher.
Yes.
In the families who tend to be less chronically homeless, you know, at any one point you'll have more, but their time in homelessness tends to be less, especially if it's a two-parent family that's hit a bump in the road and they can more rapidly recover from that. I mean, single women with children, especially with domestic violence, you know, often go through cycles of homelessness. So it kind of depends on what you're comparing.
And drug and alcohol use as well as mental illness certainly contribute to prolonging homelessness.
Sometimes it's how you say things to get people's attention.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting here looking at the question I got that says, how much is today's healthcare climate? What I meant by that when I wrote it down is the increasing costs of healthcare and the increasing number of people without healthcare insurance, about 46, 47 million mm-hmm. at the last count, contributing to homelessness. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't think of our, you know, if I were to say, well, you know, homelessness is due to not having health insurance or not having appropriate health care. We wouldn't think of it. But what's your experience in that regard?
Yes, I think it affects homelessness in a huge way. First of all, there are people, and particularly I would say families, but even individuals who have maybe have health care. Maybe it's inadequate or they've lost their health care. All it takes is one serious illness or accident to put people into a financial situation that they may no longer be able to pay for housing, for food, for utilities. So in that sense, it does contribute to homelessness in a large way. Also, people who are homeless already, and because they don't often, very often, do not have coverage for health care, when they are sick, when they are ill, can't afford the treatment that they need. So it contributes to the length of homelessness. It's hard to find a job. It's hard to go out and look for an apartment when your blood sugar is off the wall, when your blood pressure is sky high, when you have an infected leg. So lack of insurance really, I think, from my perspective, plays a huge part in homelessness in this city and elsewhere.
And I would agree with that in all facets of homelessness, whether you're talking about families or individuals or whichever that might be.
You know, even I think people who are comfortable, even middle-class folks, it really is astonishing how easy it is to rack up huge healthcare bills. If you don't have good coverage or if you don't have any coverage, one illness, one injury can really put people into a financial tailspin.
We remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Today we're talking with Sister Jackie Stoll and Susan Bomolansky of Catholic Social Services about health care and the homeless. If you've got questions or comments, a couple of ways to get a hold of us before 3 o'clock, and the sooner the better if you want to get your questions addressed. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email me at lineone, lineone, all one word, at kska.org. So the converse of the or opposite or vice versa of the question I asked before, how much does homelessness contribute to health care issues?
Homelessness, it contributes hugely to health care issues, I think. We know that the homeless can be 4 to 5 times more likely to be ill than individuals who do have a home. And this is due to a lot of different factors, lack of nutrition, lack of sanitary living environments, exposure to the elements, exposure to drug and alcohol use. All of those things contribute to the likelihood that somebody who is homeless is going to have some sort of medical problem. About two-thirds of the population, of a homeless population, well, actually, the statistic is about two-thirds of the people who present to clinics for homeless individuals will have acute illnesses, and about one-third have chronic illnesses. So it is not an environment, a friendly environment to be in if you are sick. There's no respite. The other big issue we have here in Anchorage is that there is no respite care. If someone is sick and needs to lie down and rest and recuperate, there is no place to do that. Brother Francis is a shelter for sleeping. And in the day, the majority of the people need to be up and out. And there, we just don't have the facilities for people to lay down or to sit, get off their feet and recuperate from illnesses. And that's true around the city.
So if you were homeless and had pneumonia, for example, you might be able to offer them some treatment that could keep them out of the hospital, but they have no place to go to be during the day.
Exactly. Most often I can get them the antibiotics they need, but they still have to go outside. Mm-hmm. They still have to go to Bean's Cafe and across, which is better than being outside, but it's a huge group environment, hundreds and hundreds of people in one room at a time, and they have to sit up. They can't sleep during the day. So it is not an conducive
healing. And that might
be
pneumonia in mid-January.
Mid-January might be pneumonia in the middle of summer. It doesn't really matter what it is. There is no place to go and to recuperate.
Mm-hmm. And especially to recuperate with any kind of oversight. I mean, you know, even if there was something we could do to have them stay at Brother Francis Shelter, we don't have medical personnel there other than Sister Jackie, and she's can't be there 24/7, 365. So, I mean, one of our requirements is that people have to be able to self-care. And that has become an issue in different circumstances. Now, if there's a something that's acute, that'll just take a few days, you know, we'll work with people around that. But, you know, our staff doesn't have medical training other than CPR and first aid.
And, you know, the one of the biggest diagnoses that we see, of course, respiratory tract infections are number one. The second is wound care and skin issues, wound infections and skin issues. And frequently, people with wounds need to have a place to care for those wounds, need to be up, need to be off their feet with their extremities elevated, none of which is available to them. So it really contributes to developing very chronic wounds, which are very difficult to treat.
The respiratory illness, frankly, makes sense to me as a pediatrician. You get illness not because of the weather. We've heard that a thousand times. Not true, but because exposure to sick people.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Kids get sick in schools, unfortunately. And these people are all living together. They're poorly nourished. They're under
a lot
of stress. They're not able to take care of themselves. So they're going to get respiratory illnesses. And most of these are going to be viral and transmitted person to person.
Yes.
So respiratory illness makes sense. What I don't understand, and I'd like to understand better, is what about the wounds and skin issues and so forth that's number two? Why is that?
Well, people who are homeless are at greater risk for trauma for many reasons, falling down, lacerations, burns. Oftentimes they're out building fires to keep warm, and they'll get burned. Also, people who are homeless are at a greater risk for physical violence and abuse. So they are they develop wounds very easily. And the problem is, of course, then they have no way to care for them. You and I might go directly to the sink and wash it off with soap and water and put a nice Band-Aid on it. Well, they don't have water, running water or soap to care for it. What starts as a small laceration can end up, and often does end up, as a huge problem with cellulitis, chronic wounds. It just, they're very difficult. It's very difficult to manage when you don't have running water, soap, Band-Aids, the bare essentials.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's another situation where you almost can't put yourself in that position unless you've been there or you're working with individuals in this situation. Because I couldn't,
It is hard to imagine. Yeah. It is hard to imagine. I had a gentleman tell me the other day that I explained to him very well about how to care for his wound. And in the end, you know, we talked about washing it with soap and water every day. And in the end, he said, well, I'm going to have to use rainwater. And it just took me a minute to took me back for a minute after all these years. I don't know why I was surprised. But those are the kinds of conditions many people are living in. Yes.
Another issue is exposure problems. And obviously, you know, cold injury. Are there other common injuries that might be worth people learning about?
I think that common injuries, certainly exposure is one of them. Frankly, actually, honestly, when I came here, I thought I would see more difficulties with frostbite and thermal injuries, but have not really, of course, we do see them, but not to the great extent. I think, interestingly, the homeless themselves are very much aware that they're at risk for frostbite, and oftentimes will take as much care as they possibly can to prevent that from happening. Now, we still see it, but not as much as I think one might expect, or I would have expected. I think another injuries, oftentimes people, you see, we all see folks standing at the stoplights with signs near traffic. That is actually a very dangerous thing, I find, because oftentimes there are perhaps under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and very frequently will get hit by cars and vehicles. So I think that that's another area that was sort of unexpected for me here, the numbers of people who have been traumatized by being hit by cars and vehicles in traffic.
There's quite a high percentage of traumatic brain injury. Now, whether that's a cause or an effect of homelessness, I'm not sure, but I hear that down. And,
There is, you know, there's violence. It's a violent way to live, too. They are attacked. There are fights. There are things like that. Now, it's not, again, it's not a constant thing, but when you are living under these kinds of conditions, people get desperate, and I think that that's an expression of some of their desperateness.
It's a little bit off the subject, but perhaps bring it up, is my understanding is the homeless are not the perpetrators of a lot of illegal activity. They're more the recipients, as we unfortunately have seen recently in some headlines, apparently.
Yes.
Is that true?
Well, in my experience, it depends. Now, you know, here in Anchorage, I find – I've worked with people in New York City and in Boston and – other larger cities where there is a lot more illegal drug use. Now, we do have some drug use, don't get me wrong, but proportionately it's nowhere near some of the other places that I've been. I think illegal drug use tends to up that the crime in homeless populations. So here I find that that's not necessarily the case, except for the public inebriation kind of issues. They are definitely more the victims of crime. It's easy to come upon somebody who's passed out and to, you know, roll them for their wallet or, as we've seen in the paper today, take out whatever kinds of anger you might have.
In fact, the legislature here in Alaska added homelessness to the list of hate crimes in the statute or law. I'm not sure what it was called, but they added that. So if it becomes a hate crime if someone does that, you know.
We have a caller from Wasilla, and I want to take that lady's call now. Doris, you're on line one?
Yes. I live out in the valley, and several times I've seen homeless people out here, teenagers mainly, and maybe some older people too. And I'd like to know what can be done for them, because there's no place out here for anybody like that. Maybe teenagers, but I don't know where.
Well, have you heard of Covenant House?
No.
Here in Anchorage, Anchorage has Covenant House, and they work specifically with teenagers. And I bet that would be a connection there. I'm sure you could even call them.
But if they're out in the street, how would they ever get there? They have no money, no food. They're probably cold and hungry.
Covenant House does have an outreach program. I don't know if it goes all the way out to the Valley, but I bet they would be able to work with you on that, on trying to connect with the people if they were made aware of that situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I myself don't have transportation, and that's one of the hardest things to get.
Mm. Yep, yes, I agree.
Yes, it is. It's very difficult.
I mean, I'd be happy to call Covenant House and relay your concerns to them about homeless teenagers in the Valley.
Yeah, well, could you give me a number for that place? Yeah. I could maybe get, if I ever meet anybody, I maybe could give them their phone number.
Mm. Sure, I don't have it on the top of my head.
If you would you share a contact number with us, and we will get back with you on that?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Yep. Go ahead.
You want my phone number?
Yes, if you don't mind sharing.
You would not give it to anyone else.
If you're at all worried about that, don't do it this way. You can email.
Yeah, you're on the radio.
Yeah. Why don't you?
No, I don't want to put it.
Yeah.
In
email me. Email at.
I don't have such a thing. I'm lucky to have a phone.
How about I give you my number and you can call me?
Yeah. Call.
This is Susan Bomolaski. My number is
222-7351,
and I will get that number and.
What is your name?
Susan. Just Susan's fine.
7351.
Yes, 222-7351.
Okay, thank you.
Great.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
What about all these chronic illnesses that those of us who are not homeless have? Arthritis, diabetes, hypertension. I can't imagine the difficulty in trying to manage that.
Yeah. It is a challenge. It is a challenge. Ideally, we would say that providing health care for the homeless, you wouldn't necessarily alter your plan of treatment. It would be the same as any individual that you would see for those kinds of diagnoses. However, the reality is that you do have to do things a bit differently. For instance, if you're treating hypertension, we would say that normally, under normal circumstances, you wouldn't necessarily treat someone for one elevated blood pressure reading. You would like to have them come back, perhaps in the next week or two, to make sure that that blood pressure is still elevated before you start them on medication. Well, that's not feasible, really, in the homeless setting. If you have somebody who has got an elevated blood pressure, you do have to make some decisions pretty quickly about whether or not this is something that needs to be treated, because you may not necessarily get the opportunity to see them back again as often as you would like them to. I mean, another approach, which would be standard in any other practice, would be to recommend dietary restrictions. Again, not possible in the homeless setting where they don't have control over their food intake. Same with other chronic illnesses such as diabetes. Many people with diabetes end up on insulin. That is something that is extremely hard to deal with in a homeless setting. No place to store the insulin. People lose or have their syringes stolen. Again, diet is difficult to manage. So you have to be a bit creative in approaching chronic illnesses with individuals who are homeless, and acute illnesses, actually, for that matter.
When I think of homelessness and people living together, one of the big respiratory illnesses that would bother me is tuberculosis.
Yes.
And my understanding is that although it may not be a big issue here, the multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis, which we may want to help people understand a little bit better, is often finding its way around in the homeless and in the population that are drug abusers. And
yes.
that's a nasty kind of illness. Do you all survey for that? Are you constantly
yes.
aware of that? And do you take precautions
oh,
to prevent
yes.
the spread of it?
Yes. Yes. TB is a huge issue in the homeless population here, and not as much here, but certainly around the country, and in particular, resistant TB. And that is a strain of TB that usually when people are diagnosed with TB, they are given three different medications to treat that tuberculosis infection. In resistant TB, we know that it is a kind of TB that does not respond to one or more of those standard three medications. And so those individuals have to be on very different meds, very special medications, and can take longer to treat. It's much more difficult to treat. Here in Alaska, TB, obviously we don't have the numbers of people that we do in other areas of the country, but we do have issues with TB. And in particular, in 2006, there seemed to have been a real spike in the number of TB cases reported in the state of Alaska. As it turns out, in that year, there were 70 cases, which was more than double of the number of cases from 2005. And when they took a look at why this was happening, it does. They looked specifically to see how many of those cases were in homeless individuals, and 28 of those 70 cases were from homeless individuals, which is a relatively high percentage of cases. It seems in that particular instance that probably at least four, maybe as many as 12 of those people were not diagnosed until they were already symptomatic, and 19 of those individuals probably had the same chain of transmission, meaning they probably knew each other or came in contact with each other in some way, and it's likely that could have been through the congregate living situation in shelters. Since then, the Anchorage Municipality, the Municipal Department of Health, has come and done TB screenings on a regular basis at the shelter. They come they try to come quarterly. It's somewhere between two and four times a year that they come to screen people for tuberculosis. It's a challenge to screen people who are homeless for TB. Normally, you would do it with a little skin test. But in the homeless population, that's very difficult to do because you can't necessarily get them to come back to check that little skin test to see if it's positive or not.
I need to take another short break and remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 on KSKA Anchorage. Tonight's edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection at 8 p.m. is recorded and is not accepting phone calls. Support for Line 1 comes from the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with a wheelchair on the sign. Children given positive attention and experiences during their early years are more likely to become smart, productive members of society. High-quality early education translates into higher graduation rates, better job readiness, and less crime and welfare dependence. So when you support a young child, you're supporting the economy. For more on early learning, visit bestbeginningsalaska.org. Early learning, it's everybody's business. This message comes to you from KSKA and Best Beginnings.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host, and today we're talking about the health care of the homeless with Susan Bobulowski and Sister Jackie Stoll of Catholic Social Services. If you've got questions or comments, we've got about 10 minutes to go. 550-8433 is our local number. 1-888-353-5752 is a toll-free number, and you can email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And I want to thank Marilyn, who has emailed in and given us the Covenant House phone number as well. If a previous caller is listening, it's 272-1255 for Covenant House, 272-1255. there's some risk to you for doing this kind of service. So I have to ask about, have you converted your TB test? And have you?
No, surprisingly, I have not. I've been working with homeless population and people who are at risk for TB for many, many years. And fortunately for me, I have not converted. I am tested regularly, though.
I would think so.
Yes, I am. At least once, sometimes twice a year, yes.
Kiddo.
Yes.
How about psychiatric disorders? We've mentioned that earlier. How much do you think that's a significant relationship in the people you're dealing with day to day? And if so, what kind of psychiatric disorders are we talking about?
Well, yes, it is significant. In last year, the Caring Clinic saw about 662 clinic visits. And of those, we had either for mental health alone or mental health and addictions, about half of our clinic visits were related to that. So it is significant, and I think that it's a difficult issue. Again, I'm seeing the people who are ill in the shelter, so these are people who are having difficulties with their mental illnesses. Typically, depression is a huge issue, and we could all, I think, understand why. If you are living in a situation with a couple of hundred or more other people every day, day in, day out, it's very depressing. A lot of our individuals come from home settings that have been difficult that have led to them being where they are. So I would say depression is number one. But we also do see the more serious versions of mental illness, the bipolar disorders and schizophrenia as well. It's a huge challenge because in Anchorage, the options for mental health treatment are very few, and the medications are very expensive, and it's difficult to get people to be seen by a mental health provider, and it's also difficult to get them the medications that they need. We do what we can. I do what I can, but it can be very a huge challenge.
We also try to partner with Anchorage Community Mental Health Services on that. In fact, they have a staff that comes to the shelter. But again, it's if the people are there, if they're willing to engage, and then the follow-up.
Yeah, they do. They come and visit. It's really, of course, on my part, it's the medication management that is the biggest issue for me. And that is can be very difficult. As I said, the medications are very expensive.
What happens to an individual that you see who is beyond the ability of your clinic to care for them? What happens to that individual at that point?
Well, and I should say that the clinic is really set up as more of an urgent care type clinic. Although we do manage some chronic illnesses, the preference is not to, because we are not necessarily set up to deal with people for long term. But when we see people that have issues that obviously need more attention and more help than we can give them, we have a couple of options. Certainly, if it is a very acute and life-threatening, we call 911 and have them taken to an emergency room immediately. Sometimes we refer people to go to the emergency room if it's, you know, maybe, oh, they look like they might have a broken arm and need to have an X-ray done. They can get there on their own volition. And also we try to connect people to places where they can get ongoing health care. So, for instance, either the VA, Native Health Center, or the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center are the three places where we try to get people connected with as soon as possible. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes for a lot of reasons they don't follow through. But those are the main sources, I think, of health care in our city.
I was surprised you didn't mention the emergency rooms.
Well, the emergency rooms, yes, frankly, the emergency rooms, yes, are there. And probably, I think, for the most part, that's where most of our individuals end up in reality. Yes.
Yeah, and the point, I guess, I was trying to make sure people understand is it's illegal for an emergency room to not see somebody
absolutely.
That needs to be seen.
Absolutely.
And regardless of the ability to pay.
Oh, absolutely.
But it doesn't lend, I mean, that's an expensive way to do things, and there is no ongoing care. You were thinking along the chronic disease
yes,
model,
I was.
I
was thinking
is how I would understand it. But,
yes.
But we still have that bind is that we need to be able to well,
yes.
ideally, not have as many homeless.
yes, but you're right. And homeless individuals really do tend to utilize emergency rooms as their primary care, the primary sources of medical care. And actually, I'm looking at one statistic that in 1 year in Boston, 18,000 emergency room visits were by homeless individuals. So, and they estimated the cost really for each individual as being over $28,000. So, you know, it is a huge drain on our medical system in general. And I think one of the reasons why healthcare is so expensive, it's definitely a contributor to that.
We have a, I think, a very good question that has come in by email. And it is, the question is, in your experience, do people leave rural Alaska for medical reasons, that is physical or psychological, and subsequently become homeless in Anchorage? In other words, do health care needs motivate out-migration from rural to urban Alaska and then lead to more homeless population?
I think that that does happen. I think that individuals, particularly I would say people who have substance abuse or mental health issues, tend to end up in Anchorage for a lot of reasons, but I think primarily because they are not able to cope in the villages with those kinds of problems and the conflicts that they create between family members and other community members. I'm not so sure about the other physical diagnoses, though. I know that oftentimes when people do come into the city from the villages for My experiences have been that oftentimes it's work-related, or then they bring with them medical issues that perhaps have not been addressed while they were out in the village.
I hate to do this to you. I only got about a minute left, but my one of my questions I want to make sure we get to is, what are the primary problems you face day-to-day in caring for the homeless? What are the day-to-day frustrations that
The day-to-day frustration for me is the lack of ability to follow up with individuals. Really, I think we need to be able to go to where they are and to be able to bring the services that they need to where they are in order to to adequately address their health care needs. You cannot look at this in the same way as you look at other medical practice models where people come to you. It just doesn't work successfully. You've got to be able to get out to where they are. And that is one of, I think, my biggest frustrations.
And we didn't get to it, but I know you both would be in favor of somehow finding more homes for the homeless as a way to help.
Yes, there's a program called Housing First. It's been proven across the country that when people are in stable housing, even if they continue negative behaviors, that their health care improves.
Yes,
all right.
Absolutely.
My thanks today to Sister Jackie Stoll and Susan Baumolaski of Catholic Social Services. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great
next
to
week,
be here.
We're going to be talking with Dr. Paul Offit, one of the real stars in vaccine research, about his most recent book, Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and A Search for the Cure. Why don't you join us next Monday at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m.
Your Health Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA. Anchorage.